very much. What we're going to do, the format is we're going to take a batch of five questions, comments. I'll ask you to keep them crisp, concise, so that we can get more into the discussion. And then we're going to allow the panelists, the minister, as well as Ambassador Sultan to reply, and then we'll take another round. So I'm opening up the floor for discussion. I recognize Honourable Member Noor James, Sultan Ramba, Ian Davidson. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the briefing that we received. Let me start by saying that I think that our approach as South Africa to the BRICS consortium ought to be from the point of view of our national interest, obviously. And I'm inclined to be an aggressive mercantilist in this, in the sense that I think that the more we trade, the more we grow jobs there, and there is in most potential for us to trade, just to make that point. But given the size of our economy relative to the BRIC consortium, it would be to our great advantage to pursue an agenda of regional integration in fact. And so any relationship between South Africa and the BRICS country must be accompanied by a strategy for regional integration. So point number one is firstly. Secondly, in order to do that, we need to be able as a country to sell South Africa abroad, and that requires, let's say, a legally ordained, organized, productive relations between the private sector and government. And we don't have that. Our relations between the private sector and government presently is either too cozy and too intimate, or it is too hostile. So some companies in the private sector are hostile to government and others are too close to it. What we require is an organized system where the country's interests are central and where it's legally ordained in a professional manner. So that needs attention. There are well-known tensions between the DTI and HERCO in terms of the place of trade and the promotion of economic diplomacy. Those are fairly standard tensions, and always tensions like that in a country which has two separate departments. Australia has a single department of trade and foreign affairs. So under globalization, and where ambassadors and high commissioners ought to be involved in economic diplomacy, because the political diplomacy happens between prime ministers and presidents and your global organizations, we need to have our high commissioners and ambassadors sell and understand the private sector, know the South African company, and position it. And I must tell you, my impression is that our ambassadors are cheap on this job, and they do not put their country's interest first in terms of selling our companies abroad. So that requires attention. And just finally, I was a little surprised, I must say, that when you spoke about our comparative advantages, you didn't mention our people. Why is there nothing about the South African people as one of our comparative advantages? And we know that if that is part of the strategy, we need to invest in South Africans, you invest in education, you invest in universities. As long as having a speculative array, unless you have a pipeline of graduates in astrophysics, in radio astronomy, do we have such a pipeline? So the point I want to make is that one of the comparative advantages that South Africa must develop is our people, because in the end, that's the only real resource we have. So, those comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the Deputy Minister and to Dr. Bondi for a really interesting, and I thought, quite complimentary presentation. I was particularly fascinated by the approach that Dr. Bondi took with regard to positioning the BRICS work in Bandung and in the beginning of the discussions around South-South cooperation. And I was particularly interested in what he said about this evolving relationship. And the fact that we can shape this, and the fact that he saw, in a sense, it as a bit of a continuum into BRICS from the original discussions that took place in the 1950s in the non-aligned, the development of the non-aligned movement. And when I was listening to the Deputy Minister, I was going to say a few things. I thought that we should say that it is really quite extraordinarily impressive the amount of trade that has emanated from the BRICS partners to South Africa, between us and them, but also to Africa and them, and between Africa and them. But the question arises in my mind, what is the role of BRICS in that growth? Is it not the bilateral relationship we've established between China and South Africa, between other countries in Africa and India, that has actually been the driving force in that growth? It's impressive and it's significant, but to what extent is the BRICS structure an instrument in developing that trade? And if it is not an instrument, then that opens up the question that I think Dr. Zongli opens up about how do we see this thing evolving? I think in the same breath, one cannot divorce a discussion about BRICS and our role in BRICS and our comparative advantage in BRICS with all the other organizations that we belong to. How do we engage, how do we see BRICS in respect of our membership of the G77 plus China, in respect of our relationship with the G20, in respect of our relationship with the non-aligned movement? And in particular, IPSA, which has been very little mentioned here. Somebody talked about a parliamentary BRICS group, which is great, but we have an IPSA BRICS group. Where's that in this whole thing? Are we now going to focus all our attention on developing our South-South relationships through a new vehicle, which is BRICS? And if so, why are we ignoring Turkey and Indonesia in the mix? Because it seems to me that a lot of the analysis that's been done recently shows that, in fact, BRICS countries are no longer the slave of the investment bubble. Turkey is playing a huge role on the African continent, from what we see. So I think those are very important questions to ask, but to help us to understand what the grand plan is through our involvement in multilateral and other plurilateral, and all these words I never really quite understand. There's like four questions that I'd like to ask the Deputy Minister. On page that is not paginated, the role of South Africa in BRICS, it talks about a cabinet strategy, cabinet approval of a BRICS strategy, and describes it as classified as top secret. And I wonder why such a strategy would be top secret. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Davidson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In a sense, it follows on from Stefan Merz, but let me first make one central point. And that is, I think BRICS has enormous potential as a developmental tool. I don't think we should get too romantic about it being, as was stated, something which will remap the contours of political and economic power in the world. I think that's going a bit overboard. And I think the reason why it's going overboard is because this is not a partnership of equals. In fact, if one looks at the partners themselves, spoken about size, the population, GDP, a whole range of factors, but it's not the same in terms of the nature of economic development in each of those countries, but more particularly in terms of political orientation. The two autocracies and the three thriving democracies there. And what underpins that, my remark there, is that if it's going to be a global power, there's got to be a common value, fully a value system that pulls together like other international organizations, if it's going to end our interests. But BRICS hasn't developed that as yet. I think if it's going to exercise power in that context, there's got to be some sort of common value system. But I want to focus on something else, and that is there's a kind of internal contradiction in Greece. And that although it is a developmental organization, one of the problems in that context is China in and of itself. I mean, we made the point that there has been huge growth in trade between China and China and South Africa. That was what appears to veil, I think it's an incentive to increase on that, but it was what appears to veil and look at the nature of that trade, and it's all commodities versus, and commodities are manufacturing in. And that's a critical point. And that is this. I mean, if it is going to become a partnership of equals, then one of the first things that South Africa needs to do, and other countries which are trying to develop a manufacturing base, and we see that as far as Brazil is concerned, ourselves, even Russia and India, is to look at the renminbi as currency and its undervaluation. And I see no voice from South Africa talking about that as a critical issue. Because until a proper value is established of the renminbi, then in fact we will always be at a disadvantage and they will always be at an advantage. And that's something that needs to be approached, and we need to ask the other four partners of BRICS to make sure that that is spoken about, put on the table, because otherwise it will continue to be a relationship of non-equals. And that's critical. The last point I wanted to make, I think I've forgotten the last conversation, but I thought that would be very profound, but it's obviously not. The other thing that I wanted to make is that I wonder whether in the strategy that we look at, we're not taking account of the fundamental change that's taking place in China itself, of it going from an export-led economy into a consumption-led economy, and the impact that it's going to have on trade relationships right throughout the BRICS countries. I think it is going to be significant, and I think one has to look through that and work through it, because it's obviously going to impact the extent, because clearly it is going to be a change. We'll look at the nature of societal change that are taking place, minimum wages, aspirations of the middle class, the growing shortage of skilled labour, the whole question of land, and developing those contexts. China's changed, and with that the power of China is going to change, and the pressures for the renminbi to change are going to be huge, and we've got to be part of that pressure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm actually going to ask Deputy Minister Anil Sukhal, as well as Dr. Dorothy, to respond before I take a second round, because I think there were a number of critical issues that actually started forming the discussion.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Namir, with the DDG and Mr. Sokal, who's a share power, the sole share power, I never understood what it meant, of BRICS. And he just come back from visiting all the BRICS countries at that summit, and I'm sure he will contribute to answering some of the questions. Yes, we agree that I think one of the issues is the question of integration, regional integration of SADC. And that is on the top of our agenda as well, South Africa's agenda, that we should push for the integration of the region. Also, of course, the trilateral agreement that we have with SADC, COMESA, and the EAC, which is a very important development, because you want to create a very huge market. You know, India, China, and Brazil has this huge market, which is to their advantage. And our DTI is working on this trilateral, this free market between the three economic regions, to create a market of between 500 to 600 million people. Of course, the private sector will be involved when we have this business council. the point some people would think that the hostile or causal relationship. Last Sunday, yesterday, the other Sunday, president and chaplain minister had his day. And he's out of the business community in Korea. Then he discussed the question of relationship between government and business. And I think that meeting after all had not one part of the meeting, but it was a very positive meeting. The question of trade with China, it has increased tremendously. We have this strategic alliance with China that was signed by President Zuma, I think it was 2008. The Chinese are saying that, look, we want to buy your finished products. Tell us exactly what you got. The DTI has identified 10. They had a whole list, I think, of 400 or so, but they identified 10 finished products, value-added products, was presented to the Chinese. So that our trade become more balanced rather than just raw material. And the question of this is a very important economically, you could see, even geographically, if you look at the population and the land mass. It's a very important important getting together of these countries and important alliance of countries. And how much impact will it have on reshaping the international financial or economic institutions, or financial institutions, and what role it's going to play in the coming years. You could see the figures. Economists are saying that not very long that the Chinese economy will surpass the American economy. That would not mean that the standard of living of the Chinese will be greater than that of the United States because of the population. But these are economic powers, these are the growing forces, and they must have an impact on the world economic system and the world political and financial system. We work as years ago that all five BRICS countries were members of the Security Council. And I must say that we work together with them and we reach consensus on a number of issues, political issues. And if you look at the BRICS Declaration, that also comments on some international political issues. So we're moving towards trying to get consensus on a number of tropical issues that we have in the world. The DTI and therefore you are right that a lot of emphasis now is on economic diplomacy. The DTI, I must say, have not the capacity to put people in our embassies all over the world. But what we have done is therefore we have a special course on economic diplomacy, which we are now training our diplomats to deal with economic diplomacy that we have posting. Now, it is true that this partnership may not be equal. But I think we passed the stage where we are
parking where they started because you've been part of this, you've got to be part of this. Rich is an important get together, an important instrument. And Africa had to be present in BRICS. And who's the other country that is qualified to be part of BRICS in South Africa? I think there was a number of countries that wanted to be part of BRICS at a certain stage. It was Mexico, Argentina, and I'm not sure what country. But BRICS chose South Africa because they knew that Africa was an important developing point. And you cannot have an alliance of BRICS without Africa being present there. And I think I'll ask attendees to come up to respond to some of the other questions. And why is it that the cabinet memo was toxic?
Thank you, Deputy Minister. I think you have covered most of the areas, but maybe just to elaborate, firstly, our approach to BRICS is a three-track approach. Firstly, to advance our national interest. Secondly, to advance the African agenda, which includes regional integration. And thirdly, to work with our BRICS partners in collaboration in influencing the global political, economic, and financial agenda. This is the three-track approach we use in approaching our BRICS agenda. With regard to the issue of relations between the private sector and governments, last year in preparation for our participation in the BRICS Business Forum, Minister Davies convened the business sector in a meeting in order that both government and the private sector interact with each other and that we have a common approach in terms of what we'd like to get out of this interaction with regard to the business interaction. But also, what we observed that was happening at the BRICS summit is that you'd have the BRICS business sector meeting and you had major captains of industries from all of the BRICS countries coming, and on the eve of the summit they meet, have a very good meeting, and file a report to the trade ministers and its subsidiary. What we picked up in Delhi was a complaint from the captains of industries that they fly from all over the world and they don't get an opportunity to speak directly to the leaders. That's why this year for the summit in South Africa, for the first time ever, that we're having a breakfast meeting on the morning of the summit, the first event is a breakfast meeting between captains of industry and the private press leaders. That's never happened before. So that the deliberations they have the day before, they can take it into this direct meeting with the BRICS leadership, and it can be this opportunity for cross-fertilization between the intergovernmental processes and the private sector. So I think there is some corrective action in that regard. Now that means the tension between DTI and DIRCO is not something new. I'm saying this, you referred to DFAT, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. I spent an entire month in Australia in that ministry on capacity building. It's one ministry but two different departments. And they fight. They fight for space. That is natural throughout the world. Now let me also remind that of the 136 missions we have, DTI CISA is in about 30 missions. So who does economic work in the other 90 or so missions? It is DIRCO. We are advancing also as part of our core mandate, the economic agenda. That is why last year we undertook a training course for all of our heads of mission, either in the region or at home. We brought them back and took them through an economic diplomacy course in which DTI was integrally involved, because Minister Davis acknowledges that DTI doesn't have the capacity to fully conduct the trade and investment agenda of South Africa, that we have to work in tandem with each other. Furthermore, we did the same for the second in charge. All of our missions, the second in charge, we brought them home for an economic diplomacy training course to empower them. And what, of course, there's a mindset that has to be changed. Colleagues of DIRCO think that they must go and do political work, and that is the mandate, or cultural work, or tourism work. We are saying to all of our diplomats, from the level of head of mission downwards,
Economic diplomacy is your core mandate as much as political work is your core mandate. We live in a changed global environment. You cannot survive as a diplomat today if you think you can go to any mission and just concentrate on economic diplomacy. I think many of you that came to Brussels will know this. As part of my core mandates, I was very involved in the IPA negotiations, equally as much as the DPI was involved. I knew every issue about the IPA that did have, and I was an important contributor to those negotiations. So we have to have an integrated approach in terms of our diplomatic work. I will take back and find out who's our ambassador, through the Oversight Committee. I agree with regard to the other major asset of South Africa, it's our people. And one of the things we are looking at, we had agreement in Delhi that we need to create a youth forum. So we hope during our tenure we'll have a youth and women forum, the first such meeting of the BRIC countries, so that we bring civil society into this equation as well. So I would like to think that the bilateral relations that we have with all of these countries is a major contributor in moving trade. In fact, the figures we gave, there were 2 level figures. Our trade with China last year exceeded 200 billion rands. Now, if you take SADC as an example, we have excellent relations with all of our SADC countries, very strong trade relations. But the SADC free trade agreement that came into force in 2008 acted as a further accelerator in terms of advancing trade between ourselves. So while you have the bilateral, strong bilateral trade between our BRICS countries, bringing us into an equation like we have with the BRICS itself as a further push factor in opening opportunities and further advancing trade. The BRICS Business Council that we will create, that will be launched at the summit, is going to be an important entity in advancing trade collectively between BRICS. Secondly, the agreement we signed last year in Delhi to facilitate trade in the common currency, that you can only have in such a configuration. We don't have it bilaterally between India and South Africa, between South Africa and Russia. But as a collective among BRICS, we have created this very important entity. Now the activating of the BRICS Business Council, I think you're going to see this agreement materializing. And I would say the same also of any other regional group, be it the EU, be it ASEAN, that bilateral agreements and arrangements between countries are important. But when you act as a collective, it serves as a further push factor in accelerating interaction between these countries. IPSA is still a very important entity. It has its own flavor, its own dimension. We will celebrate this year the 10th anniversary of IPSA. And we are working towards the summit that will take place in June. And we are doing a lot of work together, especially on the development front. You know that the IPSA facilities for poverty and hunger alleviation has won several awards from UNDP. We have done projects in Africa, in the Caribbean, in Asia, and we are now looking at 2 projects in South Sudan and Sudan as well as a collective. So IPSA has its own identity and will continue to move forward. Now, let me say the issue of Turkey and Indonesia. The point was made that because of the paralysis we see on the UN front, on the multilateral front, on the trade front, that's why you have a proliferation of various regional agreements taking place because of what happened to the Doha round. On the UN front, the paralysis we see there on the political level has led to new configuration, what we call the mini-laterals. And South Africa is part of many mini-laterals, as Deputy Minister pointed out. But we are always very clear that our association with any of these mini-lateral forums is to strengthen multilateralism, because that is still the core of South African foreign policy. So therefore we are members of various vehicles. Now last year, there's another new grouping that emerged called the Civis. Civis bring together Colombia, Indonesia, Vietnam, Egypt, Turkey, and South Africa. The first meeting of Civis took place in Cartagena. I was there. South Africa was invited. So we are also part of other groupings. But, of course, BRICS is a major grouping because you're speaking of powerful emerging economies in the BRICS grouping, and Philip has a different dimension to it. Philip wants to concentrate on sharing best practices and collaborating purely on the developmental agenda. The BRICS strategy is a cabinet document. I'm sure at some stage it will become a public document. It was recently agreed to in September, end of September sometimes, to guide us in our engagement. It came out of the cabinet directive. So I'm sure the elements of it is being shared quite widely in that regard. Honorable Davidson, there can never be, ever, any confederation of equals. Cyprus is not equal to Germany in the EU. That is a plain fact. In the G8, the GDP of the USA, which is what, about $15 trillion, is 3-4 times that of Italy. And Italy in its current state cannot be equal to the USA, be it politically, financially, economically. The same in ASEAN. Laos cannot be equal to a Malaysia or a Thailand. That's the reality of global political economic configurations. There's never a situation where you have a configuration of equals. We just don't have it in this global community. Likewise, it depends how we see our membership in BRICS, and I think it was explained very clearly. South Africa brings great value. The fact of the matter, BRICS collaboration is trying to set about and bring about a new paradigm of collaboration. One is one that is based on sustainability and mutual benefits. And I think that is the keynote, that we are trying to force a new paradigm of collaboration. Africa has always been marginalized. In whatever configuration you have had, you have never been party to it. It is South Africa that has been pushing and pushing the African agenda and being accepted into many of these organizations. When we wanted to become a member of BRICS, there were many other countries. In 2010, there were about 5 countries asking to become full members of BRICS. But eventually, the 4 BRICS countries decided to take South Africa on board. Because in South Africa, they saw also a continent. You couldn't have a BRICS functioning on the global stage without an African presence. Because what is new then? You are then forging the same old relationships of the North, and the South is behaving like the North, where you marginalize an entire continent. So us learning, the BRICS actually gives greater currency to the BRICS Confederation. We are not an appendage there, we are a very important partner. And we never claim to be the leader of Africa. We've never said that. But what we say elsewhere, our foreign policy, we champion Africa's interests wherever we go. And even be it in the G20, be it in BASIC, be it in IFSA, or be it in BRICS. It is part of our foreign policy drive to ensure that African interests are championed in whatever we do. And that is why when we had to decide, as a host country, we have the prerogative to decide the theme of the summit. When we were contemplating what this theme should be, we had a very wide process of consultation, not only interdepartmentally, intergovernmentally, but also non-governmental stakeholders, some of whom are sitting here from think tanks and others. And we had about 25 suggestions of what the theme should be. Eventually we whittled that down to 3, which we took to cabinet. And it was made very clear that you cannot have a BRICS summit in South Africa without having an African dimension to it. And Deputy Minister mentioned that we have a mandate. Those 3 leaders that wrote to President last year gave President Zuma a mandate going into the Delhi summit. And that's why paragraph 36 of the Delhi Declaration has the only region-specific mention in the entire declaration is on Africa. And that's what we are doing now in terms of the summit and the Africa outreach, is a further development of what was contained in the Sangha Declaration and what was contained in the Delhi Declaration in terms of the support for Africa's development. And now we are taking that further by inviting the African leadership to deliberate with British leadership on how we can work together. Because we fully understand that the point Dr. Zondi made, which I think is a very, very important point, that all of them are competing for space on the African continent. All of these BRICS countries have very, very visible programs and agendas on the African continent. What we are saying to our BRICS partners, let us collectively collaborate. That while you may have your own bilateral programs on the African continent, there should be some collaboration in terms of how we deal with this. And I just want to say on China. China, despite the changes you're going to see, this is only natural. From an export-driven economy to a consumption-driven economy, it's not going to change the appetite for China dealing with the global community. China has liquid cash that they want to invest. Hence this development bank. This development bank is a result of some very fundamentals in terms of the multilateral development banks that exist. We have 22 globally. But go to any one of the 22, including the World Bank, and ask them, any African country, that you want money to develop a hydropower program. They will not give you a cent. The World Bank has stopped lending for hydro projects. Why? Because all developed countries are developing hydro projects. They're all going for green energy projects, new technologies. And who has it? They not have it. So you must agree to have your green energy projects where you will get your technology from the north, and where does the money go again? Why don't you help us with hydro projects like we are doing with Grandinga? There's no funding. That's why we have to look at other developing countries to assist us in getting funding for Grandinga, because the World Bank made it very clear, no more money for this kind of projects. And yet the need is the most there. So this development bank that is being mooted is precisely because there is no more new avenues or funding for the most fundamental needs with regard to our developmental agenda in the countries of the emerging markets, developing countries. And this is what this new development bank seeks to achieve, because one of the things about the new development bank, it is very clear that it will be funding for infrastructure development. Now, if you look at our theme, the theme of development, integration, industrialization, the Marshall Plan after World War, Europe had to mark on development, on integration, on industrialization. Now, trading happens. It's not unique to China, and we are engaging China very vigorously on this. Look at the colonial powers that still trade with Africa. How many of them have diversified trade with African countries? They are all extractive, they're taking our mineral resources. Did they help us over this decades of economic interaction and economic dominance on the African continent? Did they help us to industrialize? So China, India, Brazil are new players, and we are saying that's why we've got industrialization as part of this theme. Because we are saying that you can't just have the same pattern as the colonial powers. Because most of them, as Dr. Zondi said, some 60% of our countries are still dependent on foreign aid in order to survive. And we want to change that paradigm. So I think one has to look at what is happening on the global stage and how we are trying to reshape in this new configuration the way we do business with regard to Africa. And South Africa has to be a key champion in doing that, because we are part of this configuration. We are on the inside, and we have a responsibility to ensure that happens. Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry that I spoke for so long.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Dr. Slumsy?
A very quick one. I'll just comment on a few things. I like the idea about us thinking very creatively about national interest and how national interests are given expression in our pursuit of the things, because it's always a danger that if we don't do that and don't do work, that BRICS will benefit others and not benefit us, though we are BRICS ourselves. And by contrast, you say that our national interests should not be seen as being about what it is for us merely, but should encompass our values, should encompass what we stand for as a country, as an African country, and should include a statement we claim for the African country, for Africa generally. For really, we cannot be an island of prosperity in a sea of poverty on the continent. We have unfortunately historical responsibility to have stabilized the continent, for it is in our interest. I'm very keen to know myself how far we are in moving from the economic diplomacy that we've done. We've done very, very well for the past 15 years. This is why we've been there. This is why there's no single African country where we don't find South African business. I've been to outlying countries like Chad, like Burkina Faso. We find a lot of South African companies there. This was a damage. Now moving from that as economic diplomacy almost by default 200 in conference margin to put it in writing. And I really am looking forward to that. There was a process of identifying what was called anchor state at some point, and I'm not sure whether the process has moved further, because in my view, I really truly think that we should not take for granted our economic advantage of the continent for both the old and the new powers compete with us, they can outcompete us. So we do need to think carefully about that, but I don't think we should be able to go there to outcompete them in this kind of natural resources. But we have to do our business differently as a citizen of Africa as a country. And second, I think the question of people, I think it's very, very important that another member says mentioned earlier, the people must be pictured are very important. This is why I think it's my presentation by saying I'm very happy that there's an outreach happening right now with the provincial roadshow. But I really, really hope, honestly, that we don't do it because of the event coming, but we do it because we believe that we should take our people along. So even after the summit, even as we head off to new other summits, we will really take our people along and help everybody understand why should we be in Crete. Because if we don't do so, people do not know. For example, the assignment mainly because that the Czechs since China, that it takes to have, for example, the idea of drug companies to produce cheaper medicines, so that people of the African continent and Africa are able to access cheaper drugs, are important things that have been worked on that the population should know about. The questions of exchange enabling South Africans and Africans to access to educational institutions in China, in Russia, in India, in Brazil, are important things that I think we should do a better job in communicating about. And I'd like to quote another fundamental difference about the ISA bridge trade, that it is very important. We still have to do an analysis to find out whether it is an outcome of bridge as a platform, or is it an outcome of bilateral relations that have been growing over a period of time. But our trade with Brazil and Latin America has been growing quite significantly, and we used to think it was an outcome of IPSA after 2003, but we did have to do an analysis. And what is one of the biggest challenges in South Africa is to set up evidence-based policy. Our investment in research in all of these areas compared to the other partners is unfortunately weaker. And I have partners in Brazil, in India, they're generating amazing, huge structure about what could happen in this area, what could happen in this area. Unfortunately, it can't be done through donor funding. It's not the interest of donors to do that. It has to come from South Africa itself. The bulk of our research in this particular area is donor funded. That says we have not quite realized how important this thing is for us. So the bulk of what we say about this comes from donors. Even as we are critical of donors, we don't want to give it to them to fund our own knowledge generation about these things. I think we do have to think about our capacity to service many of these minerals. Because there is always a possibility that we may not be able to service all of them because the Kiva is coming and G11, there's many others coming. We need to think very carefully about it, we have to convince ourselves at least that we are able to do that. And I think the question of which are bricks has also to do with the fact that these minerals evolve very quickly and often have a time span for decision and lead to something else quicker. They can build incrementally on each other. And I really do think that the fire behind the bricks does come from itself. And remember that the Greek IPSA was an outcome of a process discussion between the Ethiopian and they could only be achieved. And then IPSA, the Greek is almost an evolution from that, and I expect that the Greeks would evolve to something else. I think we should be ready for a Turkey, for Indonesia, for Colombia, and the rest of those countries joining Greek, and then we have to change the acronym. And I think we should not be worried to let go of the acronym Greek. Но не ме е чова, не е да не е што и нам, което не е да е Бога. Very quick one, I have a comment about the Greek strategy, and I think it will help us those of us officials which say that you know about the Greek strategy, and I don't think it is a secret, because I think it should be promoted, because we have to ensure that our Greek participation is in the best interest of the country and its people. And the last point about political organization is a very big question that has been discussed another month or another, and it's not important, because what made it was very popular generally was that there was a convergence of political orientation around, you know, these are the Greek democracies of the South, but the Greeks in a different animal. And I tended to say that you don't judge Greeks on its quality. The two are quite different. And Ipsa may be actually a platform for this. The democracy of the South influenced the agendas in Greece. Because you need these platforms to influence other platforms and so on and so on. But there is a political organization that they have between the Bodhisattva and the Bulgarian declarations refer to these as shared values. Peace, stability, development, cooperation, harmony, human solidarity, multilaterality, equity and a fair world, promoting greater democracy in the world. And this is an important thing to hold them up to, not so that it is done, but it is important that they push our process in. It is also important for a second reason. It makes Greeks pro something rather than anti something. Too much of the analysis of Greeks is anti-West. And I don't think we also go into the keep having that point about this is the part of the West. I don't think necessarily so. But I think it is for something. It's about creating what we've been aspiring to create since the 1950s. And for me, the positive part of it must be emphasized more than the anti-one. Because there should be no problem in anti-something. They should be for something. And if there is something for something, others position themselves as anti-ish. Because basically, what is why we talk about the Greeks right now. It's not so much that it's anti-West, but that the West is very concerned about it. That much we know. And South Africa is in a good position to make sure that there's alignment that does not lose relationship with the West on this basis. A good one also, a very important part of its future is its ability to strengthen regional developmental and finance mechanisms. If we can help to make sure that it's possible, then African countries and other countries have alternative sources of finance. The Greeks can be careful, not be sufficient, will never be sufficient. You will have to strengthen the African Development Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the Bank of the South in Latin America, and others, so that there is a great number of options for poor countries to draw from, and also to navigate their status. And for me, our ability to bring Nepal, not Nepal as an agency, but Nepal as a paradigm, into Greek is going to be important, because there was something fundamentally interesting about Nepal that we never understood. Nepal was about development through partnership that is equal. There was African countries themselves saying they don't want to develop through dependence. They want to develop through partnership. So once they develop through partnership with the Greeks, but not want to be dependent now on the Greeks and instead of others. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'd like to open a second round of questions. I recognize the colleague in the back, Dr. Keith, Michelle, and the colleague next to Ross. And also, when you could you just introduce yourself before you comment with your comments?
Thank you. So I'm John Keith from AIDC. I think it's a very excellent, very interesting presentation today. And the most innovative and most significant dimension of this forthcoming summit is this perspective on Africa. And it's important because South Africa cannot allow itself to be and be seen as a gateway into Africa for other countries, or to speak on behalf of Africa. And it's a very important initiative that now there are going to be African representatives from the RICS and the AU and so on at the summit. Because they have to begin projecting themselves as a collectivity and trying to act as a collectivity in relation to the BRICS. Because as other people have said, if they don't, the disparity of power is so vast that each of these individual countries will never get a good deal out of India, China, Brazil, or any others. And the importance of having them here and the importance of their presence isn't just diplomatic or public relations, but this is an opportunity to create different criteria for this partnership that people talk about. And Dr. Zondi made this point, and so did Dr. Sukla, is that we are not reinventing the wheel, and we do not have to reinvent the wheel. There was a very development paradigm which was denounced, dismantled, and discredited under structural adjustments and neoliberalism. And we need to revive those criteria. The partnership is about investing where the host country needs to. Reinvesting, not transporting your capital abroad. Accepting technology transfers, being one of your obligations. Backward linkages and forward linkages and labor training and management transfers. These were well established as part of the development paradigm. And we are now in a stronger position in dealing with these BRICS because they use some of these instruments, even China does. China uses prescribed investments. They use these instruments and they say they are not the same as the old colonialists. Well, we can say to them, we accept you are not the imperialists, you are not the old colonialists. Therefore, you will agree to the development criteria that we developed in the immediate post-colonial period and that were dismantled under structural adjustments. So this is a very important occasion to re-establish, not just to go back to the development paradigm. We have to go further because now we will include gender rights and human rights and environment which was lacking in the earlier criteria. So this is a very important occasion to argue the details for a different development paradigm that builds on the past and looks to the future. And I think we have a relative advantage with these new powers, these emerging powers, which are still developing countries and which have many of the same problems as we have, although on a different scale. So I just want to put that into the discussion. If any of these countries, whether it's Nigeria or South Africa or Kenya, the strongest, try to deal with these countries on their own, they will never get a good deal because of the disparities of power. And the only way to do it is either to act collectively through the AU or at least create a framework of criteria that we put to the BRICS countries in their relations with Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Michelle? Sorry, Michelle, can you put your mic on?
I have the point about South Africa's, the three interests in BRICS, South Africa, Africa's interests, and transforming the global financial architecture. But it's not clear, you know, whose interest, what interest. And you have emphasized quite a lot of business interests and corporate interests and corporate South Africa's interests. But there's the aspect about inequality and social interests that hasn't emerged in this discussion. And our country, we know, has extreme inequality. We have surpassed as well. But it's really not clear how these spaces and forums are going to improve discussions or processes around dealing with inequality in the region. The second issue is around the feasibility of the bank. You emphasized that we have 22 development banks. Most of them operate in the framework of the IMF and the World Bank. And the Bank of the South that was initiated in Venezuela was really emerged as this bank, as an alternative to the World Bank. And I'm concerned that there isn't some synergy. And the Bank of the South is not meant to be a regional bank of South America. The South Americans are putting in the initial finances, it was really opening up to the rest of the South. And Brazil is part of it as well. So I have questions about this danger initiative around the BRICS banks, where there's already this initiative just happening. So yeah, if you could just clarify on that point. Thanks.
Thank you, Michelle. The colleague next to us.
Thank you very much for your presentation and the contribution that have been made to the debate. We all agree here that I work for the Center for Chinese Studies at Stellenbosch University. So I was saying that Deputy Minister, he mentioned about BRICS being an opportunity for South Africa to export, which is true, because you know, South Africa has opportunity to deal with different markets with big population. But what we've seen so far in terms of trade between African countries, not only South Africa, and other emerging powers, even you know, traditional powers, is that we can have an imbalanced trade, which is not based on the volume of exports and imports, but mainly on the composition of exports and imports. And some of the people here mentioned that earlier. So it is an opportunity, yes, but I think it will be very important to see how to put in place policies to boost or improve our manufacturing industries to be able to export consumer goods, not raw material. Because again, even the volume of exports from African countries to you know other trading destinations is mainly based on resources. So how different African countries can make that possible? Another thing was you mentioned about the agricultural investments, because you know Africa has empty land too. We need a lot of development in the agricultural sector, but those investments, if they can benefit the population in Africa, it would be very good. I'm talking about here how the investments in the agricultural sector will solve food security issues that we are dealing with like all the time. Because remember that we are dealing with big countries, with the world's biggest population. So those agricultural investments might be something beneficial to them to feed their biggest population there. Another point that I want to mention was the implication of the AU and NEPA, which is very important. In our framework, we did see that Africa has been late in involving these institutions in their different partnership and debate with other global partners. So it is good that you take a step vertically to put them into the discussion. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. The gentleman on the right, on the left, yes.
I'm now John, a member of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. I first want to write on the issue that the last speaker just raised on agriculture, and say that an observation is made here in the Deputy Minister's presentation that a large section of the world's population lives on less than $2 per day, and this large population is found in the developing countries, which being the player in the developing countries. And one hasn't heard a lot about that area of development, the agricultural sector, not just in South Africa, but as a member of BRICS, but in the African continent. Studies show that Africa has enough land and is rich, which is rich enough to feed at least half the world's population, and we have this hard. And I think there's a lot more concrete discussion that needs to take place on this particular issue in the African continent and within BRICS. That's the first point. The second point is in relation to the observation once more made in the Deputy Minister's presentation about our comparative advantage, particularly with regards to the mineral resources. And I know that there is a discussion going on in the African continent. In fact, there is a research going on with regards to beneficiation and value add, so far as the mineral resources are concerned. The issue that is worrying, and that's why I raised this matter, is that in the course of our conversation late last year as the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry with business, particularly the mining industry, as we raised this issue, we discussed this issue of beneficiation and value add in relation to trade and exports. A comment was made that on the part of the mining business, that their responsibility is to dig out and ship out. And I'm not saying this as in an accusing tone. It is not their responsibility to develop the manufacturing sector within the broad mining industry. And the question therefore that arises is whose responsibility is it? And therefore I want to propose that a further discussion need to take place on this particular matter. Secondly, government has got to respond to this issue. But government can't respond alone. The business has got to come into the picture. The mining industry itself has got to come into the picture and provide other solutions. Not only for South Africa, as I said, there is research already going on about mineral resources of the African continent and beneficiation and regulation. And so this conversation and the research that is coming through must provide this platform to talk beyond what the Industrial Policy Action Plan identifies and has been a conversation over the past 34 years, the manufacturing, the value addition, beneficiation, and so on. And begin to say, how does government and business, both domestically and in terms of foreign direct investment, begin to take responsibility to build this important sector within the mining industry? So that not just South Africa, but Africa as a continent begin to be more competitive. We are going to be very rich in minerals. Ourselves as South Africa, ourselves of course the largest resources of China. And we have a competitive advantage there. But we haven't gone to a stage where we can dictate terms, not even negative terms, on what has to happen with the mineral wealth of South Africa in terms of the Malika Chandra and so on. I would like to hear further comments on this issue, both from the Deputy Minister and Dr. Zwane. I hope the business sector is here so that I don't speak something that they might say is out of order. And if they are here, maybe then let's respond to that.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask the panel to respond, and if we're going to do a second or a last round of comments, questions, I want it to be very crisp, precise, so that we can wrap up, because we are together a lot of time. So I'm going to ask the Deputy Minister or Anil, whoever wants to respond to some of those. And the other thing was, in the previous session, there was a very interesting question on the currency issue of China, and just to reflect on that as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much. There are a number of questions. I'm not sure most of them. I think the point that what Keith has commented, I think he was a comment, an important comment that there has to be an involvement from the African leaders, not just South Africa now trying to lay down what is best for the continent. And I think the outreach program is a very important program that the African leaders themselves will be in direct conversation with the leaders of BRICS. As you spoke, it's a different paradigm here. Now, I didn't think that the bank that the British is going to discuss is seen as an alternative to the World Bank, but rather a complementary to the World Bank. And as it was said in one of the slides here, that there's a need for emerging markets and the developing countries to utilize the saving generated by them, an international development bank fostering sub-sub investments is required. On the matter of agriculture, land, and I think that food security is an important issue now internationally. And there are many countries, I know the Arab world, looking at Africa, I notice quite a lot of these Arab countries are buying land on the continent for what they call food security. And the question of the beneficiation generally is right, has to be done both by government and big business. We've been speaking of the beneficiation of our raw material. And as I said, with the Chinese, of course, we said to the Chinese, there has to be some type of partnership between them and the African state. It's not a question of taking raw materials out of Africa. But they have to also develop the continent in terms of infrastructure development, etc. And also engage in beneficiation. I think South Africa has taken some step through the DTI on the question of beneficiation. And I think I'll comment.
I think it's important to stress this. There are a number of mandatory meetings that happens under the BRICS architecture. Us hosting the summits is only the beginning. We have the chairship of BRICS for an entire year. And during our tenure, we will agree now in Durban on the what we call the Security Plan of Action. Our agriculture ministers met last month in Delhi. The ministers of security met last month in Delhi. Health ministers have just met. We had the urbanization forum that just took place 2 or 3 weeks ago. The friendship cities forum took place a few weeks ago. So there are a number of meetings. Perhaps you don't read of it in the media, it's not in the public domain. But there are a number of sectors where you have established work streams and collaboration is taking place at a very high level, including programs of action that have been rolled out. And that will happen during the course of our tenure. Honorable Magama spoke of the parliamentary forum. There's agreement, the North Korea Risk Parliamentary Forum, and we're hopeful that during our tenure we'll be able to take this forum forward as well. On the inequality and social side of things, yes, Prime Minister Singh, in fact, he had a 10-point agenda last year, addressing all of these social challenges which is incorporated into the BRICS program of action. It is there to look at the Delhi plan of action, and there's a lot of work going on in that front, because poverty, underdevelopment, unemployment, these are triple challenges all of the BRIC countries face. So there is a lot of collaboration on that front, and I think the point the Deputy Minister made, this proposed BRICS bank is not being developed as an alternative to anything. I think Prof. Zorgi was very correct. BRICS is not in competition with anyone. BRICS, we see a common agenda of collaboration and how we can work together in order to advance our own interests as a BRICS collective, and how we can work with other emerging market developing countries of the South in terms of dealing with common challenges. I think that's, with regard to trade imbalance, we're very mindful of that. I spoke earlier of trade with China. If you look at as recent as 2008, our trade imbalance with China was about 60 billion. It's dropped to about 23 or 24 billion. Because we are addressing it very consciously and in a very open manner with the Chinese leadership. But also, apart from this BRICS bank, let me give you one of several other things that are happening on the financial side. The DBSA and CDB, Development Bank of China, are in an advanced stage of negotiating an MOU, which will open up a facility for several billion rands of funding to the DBSA. I'm just giving that as one example. If you look at new investments, as was pointed out between Deputy Minister's presentation, investments from BRICS countries is starting to grow significantly. IMF prediction this year, advanced economies will grow by 1.2%. Its emerging markets, developing economies are going to grow at an average of 5.5%. So your capital for investment is coming from these countries. Recently, you saw the loan made available to one of our platinum countries, $600 million, a long-term investment. You'll only start looking at that mine coming on stream 2023, again from Chinese Development Bank. India, in a number of African countries, just recently $32 million investment in Uganda with a local company to produce locally in Uganda antiretroviral and anti-malaria drugs. Tata Motors have set up a plant here now, as one example. The data resources are in a number of African countries. And the point we are making, you're not coming here just to extract, you're going to come and manufacture with us. With all of these countries, that is the common message. So there's a whole lot going on in terms of the economic front with all of these countries. And it's a very vibrant space, a very vibrant space. If you are very close to the process, these details are there on a daily basis where we are seeing this kind of investments and a new paradigm of how they're relating to the African countries. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador.
A very quick one on competitive advantages that we should have with the continent. I think that there is a more with a serious conversation about our economic diplomacy, because our economic diplomacy is not merely about, you know, giving ambassadors skills to make attract investment. They should know what investment they should want to attract. Of course, we've come to know in the past 15 years and 15, 18 years that not all investments that attract actually leads to job creation. We should be systematic about what we think that we want, like every country does. Many of these emerging countries have all the regions to their trade and economic diplomacy strategies, and you can find it on the websites, and they push it very strong. We know, for example, Brazil changed economic diplomacy for Africa and decided to put 1,400 more ambassadors on the African continent. and be strong. And they decided to push their beam back of shelter with anchors, according to the condition of anchors. You know, they did not treat every private sector of countries in the same, or some are more significant than others. And they also make sure that the public enterprises are seen to be needing in an exercise. They offer conditional loans to their companies, which make it very difficult to compete with that. So they may invest in high risk areas, and they do it in a very bold way. And the challenges are really willing to be bold. We have experience to confirm, I'm sure colleagues will confirm. GGI was actually pulling back a number of economic diplomats, disclosing a number of trade offices in the world. It's very, very wide. We need to be able to put in more. So the question of strategy there, that we think really carefully about. And that includes analyzing the continent. Because one of the mistakes we do make, and I think it's very important to make this point, not every African country is equally the same, equally important. They're all important, but not equally important. If we don't do that, we will treat Nigeria the same way as Chad, and Nigeria will treat that as a negative treatment. And this is why the strategy that TGI put was called a butterfly strategy, and at the same time the speaker was exploring an anchor space strategy. It was important, both about selecting some, but I would be at peace if my government uses land strategy. We don't have a technical strategy, and the TGI strategy are about the same issue. GGI butterfly strategy is not only in operation, they may be in one, and there was anchor state strategy. I do not know whether it was finalized, and I'm worried we do not sort of things up, because one of the things we should do, we can't compete, we can't move around the place, we don't behave like that. They are very aggressive, very, very systematic. We have to at least do that. We need a lot of information. For example, we know that our spend is the financial sector, with banks and all that. It's an advantage for us if the three countries use our banks for their investments on the African continent, and as the Chinese started to do. But we should analyze what is happening there, so that our banks are able to respond to those opportunities. Because frankly, I think the movements of the banks should be seen as opportunities if we are planned properly. But we don't have information. I know this because I asked some senior executive of a big bank. They did not know really where the Chinese investment, the Brazilians, and the rest of them. And we as a country where they could, our business to flourish, we should be generating that information everywhere. On the back of the South, and I think it's very important that we and you are right, it was supposed to not be the Bank of Latin America, but the Bank of the rest of the world. I think it is important for us to champion it as a bank of North, not an anti-something bank, it's not an anti-business, but it's a bank that offers opportunities for the South, and it should invest in areas where the IMF does not want to invest, for example, in industrialization, in agriculture, in cooperating with small and medium enterprises, because those are not quite usual areas of investment for them. They want to assist countries that are under stress for these all crisis management. The last one, I think, there's a great opportunity, as the point is not mentioned there, I think there's a great opportunity out of BRICS for us to re-energize other regional mechanisms that are very specific to geographical areas. I think that we can use this to re-energize the relationship with South America. For South America is very exciting, various countries, but there's a great opportunity. There was a SACU Mercosur initiative that kind of lost steam a little bit, and at that time we thought it was overshadowed by IPSA. Because we shifted our focus to IPSA, both Latin America and ourselves. And I think there's a great opportunity here. The second one is the Indian Ocean Rim. For the Indian Ocean Rim is a strategic marine region for us. which is in the South Atlantic. Wonderful fantasy. And then the Mercosur, which is in the South Atlantic, And then the last is the New Africa, the New Asia-Africa strategic partnership that we championed together with Indonesia. And we were supposed to host a summit. It is called Sharon Kurukuam, I think. And I think it's a very important initiative that we should champion, because if we want to do things differently, there has to be region-to-region diplomacy that would enable these two regions to cooperate significantly. The Asia is establishing its plan, we call the free trade area. Asia wants to become a community by the time it gets to age of 20, and I think there are great opportunities for us to harness there. And I think Asians need us, and they need the continent through us as well. And I think there is a great opportunity there. And I think therefore it's about making sure that as we move to new areas, we don't make old areas that we're already started. Because otherwise we start afresh all of our care. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson. I'm going to take one quick round of last comments and questions. If I look, that's one thing. And if that's two, I'm going to close the session. So I'll start with you, Richard.
Yeah, thanks, Tanisha. Richard Humphries from Shaftesbury. Two very quick questions. One was perhaps more of a comment, picking up on Ambassador Suklow's point, very interesting point he made just now about the depth of sectoral collaborations that is taking place and has taken place, say, in the last month or two in New Delhi. But as a consequence of that, can we not expect, given that BRICS is a long-term strategy, it's an evolving process, isn't there a need to move away from a sort of year-by-year different government-led rollout of that year's ambitions, as it were, to something like, I use the word very loosely, an OECD secretariat for BRICS. So, perhaps a comment, if you want to say something on that, is that possibly in the pipeline? Secondly, just to pick up on Sita Marco's point about region-to-region diplomacy and the AU, this week is the AU-China strategic partnership, and it's a precursor to a whole host that will be held this year. To what extent is the AU putting forward at the China meeting as a precursor to the other meetings a new development paradigm of relationships? That's if you could just tell me what just kind of that goes to.
Thank you, Richard.
Hi, I'm Marianne Borkenshire-Goldman from Oxford. My question relates to the response on how BRICS will be addressing inequality and social issues. We're an organization which works with a lot of civil society organizations in BRICS countries. And the response was related to a number of activities highlighted in the plan of action. But those are quite broad in terms of commitments by BRICS governance to support, for example, the Rio Plus 20 initiatives being hosted by Brazil, COP 17, COP 18, etc. So beyond the plan of action, are there any other ways we're able to engage in where we can see more concrete strategies or initiatives taken on by BRICS governments to deal with poverty, inequality, and unemployment? We welcome very much the idea being proposed on the BRICS parliamentary forum as a potential way in which civil society can interact better and to engage. But are there other platforms that you envisage in the future, for example, the BRICS summit, where they have an academic forum and a business forum? Those seem to be very closed by invitation only, but are there other ways that civil society can be engaged?
Thanks very much.
The Deputy Minister or Ambassador Suklow?
I think the first point made regarding secretaries, as the point was made, the RIC is a very young configuration. It's we're just have this last summit in the first cycle of or five now. And this question of should we have a permanent secretary has come up in our discussions. But what was agreed is that what we're going to do at during our tenure, together with the other BRICS, and this was decided in Delhi, is to develop a medium to long-term strategy. Where do we see BRICS in the next 5 years? Now that will start next year with Brazil again, a new round of summits. So we also, during our tenure, putting in place a terms of reference in terms of the chairpersonship. None of this is institutionalized. As a young organization, we're trying to put structures in place, so it's an evolving process. I think with regard to the AU-China, as you know, the AU chairperson, Minister Zuma, is this week in Beijing with discussions around this collaboration. And you also know that South Africa is the current co-chair of FOCAC. We assume that co-chairship at the FOCAC ministerial at the end of June, and will host in 2015. But we work in close collaboration with the AU with regard to where we see this collaboration between Africa and China going, and being the co-chair, the champion then of Africa on this partnership, I think we are also well placed to do that. I just want to point out that Prof. Zondi made reference to IORAC, NASP and so forth. Deputy Minister was at the IORAC ministerial now in November. And for us, it's a priority organization, and IORAC is taking on a new lease of life, given that the increasing importance of the Indian Ocean, not only politically, but economically, and so forth. NAS at the summit now, AU summit, NAS has been absorbed into the AU structures as one of those AU meetings that will now be coordinated by the AU, and we had motivated for that, that it should come under the AU banner. So we're hopeful that this process together with the AU will move forward in that regard. Now, the issues, the social issues, if you look at, all, for example, the urbanization forum that just took place, if you unpack the outcome of the urbanization forum, all of the issues around urbanization, that the pressures that we face in terms of urbanization as BRIC countries and globally, all of the social issues were discussed there with some programs of action that have been put in place and how we can share best practices. We're all facing this onslaught of movement of our peoples from the rural areas to the urban areas. South Africa is 60% urbanized, much more than the global average. And this comes with a whole series of social challenges. And this is what this forum was created to discuss. Likewise, the partnerships city forum. That is exactly to look at key states. I mean, it's predicted that China, by 2025, will have 2,000 cities with a population of over 1 million each. That's not long enough. So we are looking, that's why the Friendship Cities Forum also came about, to look at the social challenges and how we share best practices and how we collaborate to jointly address some of these challenges. So it is then in these various forums that we have a platform to address these challenges. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Minister. I'm going to actually ask the Chair to make closing remarks and close the meeting for today. But before that, I would just like to thank the Portfolio Committee for engaging with CAPI and to take this dialogue forward, in particular the NAO, for actually the support and all of the collaboration in putting this together. I'm looking forward to many more fruitful exchanges and collaboration.
No, thank you. Thank you so much, Anisha. I want to thank each of you by name. Straight to make the exception in the case of the Deputy Minister. Thank you so much, and all the organizations and members of the committee and other committees who attended. Let me just, by way of introduction, make two, three remarks. This one remark really. landowners into one. The first is that there's no doubt in our minds that BRICS is a significant forum and will remain relevant and become more powerful as time goes on. But with that, clearly comes a number of other responsibilities, chief of which is some of the work that needs to be done, not only in strengthening this as an organization or a forum of various countries, but also in terms of the other important issues raised in the structures, people development and so on, that really must become the undercarriage which will determine to a large extent the success. Because the final analysis is not going to be about the blends on the table, or about GDP per capita, or projections of economies. It's going to be about how, in real terms, our association with BRICS affects the domestic situation, how it helps us abolish poverty, unemployment, underdevelopment. So that will be the measure in the road. And that has only raised an important issue. And we have as well raised this issue in the past to take an evidence approach to the evidence based in our approach in terms of measuring the impact of this thing. The Department for Instance Ambassador, I would recall one of our criticisms of GIGO, for instance, when dealing with both the strategic plan and the annual report, was precisely that lack of evidence, in terms of what we are achieving. So our view has always been and continues to be the impact it has on the lives of ordinary South Africans. If it doesn't help us abolish those fundamental contradictions that continue to define the South African landscape, it's not worth engaging in. So it becomes a near grand, project leading us to nowhere. So we are confident that we are on the right track. But this has assisted the committee to a large extent, Ambassador, in terms of information, but also in suggesting, other ways of looking at BRICS, either than merely from what we've been receiving from the department. We see to the department frequently almost giving the brief us on these issues. But it's always refreshing to have other views outside of the department. We are embarking on building a partnership with our think tanks out there and other civil society organizations, because to us what is critical is that for effect, by its very nature, it already is historically, diplomacy has always been in its history. With this National Democratic Society we seek to build, domestic foreign policy is a key objective for Parliament in particular. Because in the final analysis, it is the aspirations of these people that voted, or that vote in every election, whose aspirations should find practical manifestation in the work that we do, whether it's in government or whether it's in Parliament. We are a hand and a club, and must work together to achieve the promises we've made to our people. And to that end, the parliamentary forum, I want to reiterate, is key and critical to this BRICS mechanism. Least of all because it will help us, number one, ensure popular participation in this process, demystify this elitism around it, and domesticate it thoroughly. Secondly, and avoid what Dr. Zondi referred to earlier as the debate being informed by other issues, either than really what is fundamental to the debate. And then secondly, This will put our parliament in a position to track and show compliance and monitor implementation of these agreements taken at this very important chance, so that we see a practical manifestation of the decisions taken at the summit. And then lastly, parliament are probably the most suitably placed institutions to engage with the public on any matter. We have the way in which parliament has been set up speaks to that public participatory model and public participatory capacity. It is easier for a member of parliament or members of parliament to engage with issues of BRICS, which in the main are quite sophisticated issues that we have to be broken down to the ordinary South Africa, because we do not deal with issues of foreign policy and trade or integration. It's easier for an MP to do that both for a constituency as we normally do. Then the issue of people in terms that they understand than for deliverable for instance department to roll out an effective, you know, public diplomacy program and spend a requisite amount of time there. And so while we intention will not be to take over, so to take over the work of the department, but as I said, we are a hand in glove, and for us that's it will be important to engage with our constituencies on these issues. I have had a discussion with Ambassador Sudhir Adeniyi around this parliamentary forum. And indeed, as a broad agreement about the formation of such a parliamentary forum. However, it is incumbent upon us as members of parliament to insist in our own parliament that this organization of this forum is set up so that we are able to play the role we are supposed to play. With those few words, let me thank each of you, each of the participants who are here today, and we hope to see you very soon. I can assure you we will have more of these types of engagements to solicit your views and concerns about any matter that falls within the purview of the committee. And we hope to strengthen that relationship with you in the future, whether through a society organization or doing things. In the final analysis, all of us have the same objective, and that's to create a better South Africa, a better world, a better Africa, a better world for all of us. Thank you so much, and God bless. Just an announcement, you want to make an announcement?
Just a casual announcement, that the lunch break immediately, you know, when people go outside the shop, the lunch break. Thank you.
Thank you.